Times. I'm Marty Moss Coane. In the 19th century, the North Pole held a deep allure to the public, to sailors and adventurers. It was an unmapped part of the world, and there was a belief that its waters were ice-free and smooth. Explorers just had to find a gateway through a ring of ice to find it. In 1879, the USS Jeannette sailed out of San Francisco on an expedition to the North Pole, inspired in part by this theory that was, of course, completely wrong. Within a few months, the ship was stuck in ice, and within 2 years it sank, forcing the captain and crew to try to rescue themselves in the bitter, cold, and harsh environment. Our guest Hampton Sides tells this extraordinary and largely forgotten story in his new book. It's called In the Kingdom of Ice, The Grand and Terrible Polar Voyage of the USS Jeannette. He's an editor at Outside Magazine, a contributor to National Geographic. And Hampton Sides, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
It's great to be back with you, Marty.
Tell us about this Arctic fever that seemed to be felt by so many people in this country.
Yeah. Well, I kind of had to scrape away, you know, everything that I knew to be true about the Arctic and about the North Pole in order to try to understand what people back then thought was up there, because it was this nagging, gnawing obsession. It was like, as someone said in one of the accounts that I quote, it's like a man has to know what his own attic looks like, and it drives people insane. And it was one of the few places left that man had not touched and had not been able to reach. And so there were all these theories about what was up there. And some of the theories went back to the Vikings and the Greeks. This notion of an open polar sea goes way back. There's a map from the 1500s, a Mercator map, that shows this open polar sea with these perfectly symmetrical river channels that lead into it. And I think once you get something on a map, it becomes really difficult to dislodge it from the public imagination. And so what happens is these great scientists, all the eminent scientists, instead of coming up with their own theories or just saying, I don't know, had to enlarge upon that idea. And so the Jeannette expedition was one of the first, and it was also the last expedition to expressly test the open polar sea theory. And, you know, unfortunately, as often happens in Arctic exploration, people have to lose their lives and go through hell to test some of these theories.
And I do want to talk about it. I'd love to have you actually read a section from the book where you talk about this lure of the North Pole.
Yes. The North Pole, the top of the world, the acme, the apogee, the apex. It was a magnetic region, but also a magnetic idea. It loomed as a public fixation and a planetary enigma, as alluring and unknown as the surface of Venus or Mars. The North Pole was both a physical place and a geographer's abstraction, a pinpointable location where curved lines met on the map. It was a spot on the globe where, if you could stand there, any direction you headed in would be, by definition, south. It was a place of perpetual darkness for one half of the year and perpetual sunlight for the other. There, in a sense, chronology stood still, for at the pole all the time zones of the world converged. These things the experts understood, or at least believed they understood. But nearly everything else about the pole, whether it was ice or land or sea, whether it was warm or cold, whether it was humid or desert, whether it was desolate or inhabited, whether there were mountains or labyrinthine tunnels that fed into the earth, whether the laws of gravity or geomagnetism even obtained there, remained a terrific puzzle.
This was also a time of exploration. And as you say, this was a part of the world that, for all the reasons that would make sense, was unmapped. So I guess the fact that it was unmapped and people had not gone there just enlarged its fascination.
Up to that point, most of the exploration in the Arctic had been designed to find the Northwest Passage or to find ships that had gotten lost looking for the Northwest Passage. This was one of the first ones where they were saying, there may or may not be a Northwest Passage, but we're going to go straight to this bigger grail, this more abstract goal of finding the North Pole. there was a lot of nationalism involved too, because the U.S. wanted to beat other nations and reach it first. We had come out of the devastation of the Civil War, and we were aiming to do big things during the Gilded Age. There was some money now, and there was a growing sense of we need to kind of flex our muscles on the world stage. And this was a way to do that in lieu of war. This was this kind of quasi-military attempt to do something that was glorious for the nation.
And, of course, there were wealthy benefactors who were interested in this, including this this man named James Gordon Bennett. He was the owner of the New York Herald. As you write, a man that not only wrote about the news but made up news to sell newspapers. Mm-hmm. But he was interested in this, in these, I guess, kinds of adventures.
Yes. I mean, you couldn't invent a character.
I don't think so.
This is a gift in the narrative terms. This is a gift that keeps on giving. James Gordon Bennett was this half-mad playboy publisher of the New York Herald. He was one of the richest men in America. He inherited the Herald from his dad, and he was really interested in these serialized adventure stories. Make up, you know, not don't just print the news and cover the news, but in fact generate spectacles that will just keep producing more and more stories. The most famous of these was the story of Stanley. He sent Stanley to find Livingston in Africa, and got a huge sensation from that, both in terms of circulation for the paper, but also it produced some knowledge. It actually, you know, even though it was a newspaper stunt, it expanded our knowledge of Africa, and it led to more exploration in Africa. So he realized this was another one of those kinds of stories, and he bankrolled this entire expedition.
Wow, how much?
I never actually did the final tally, and what it would be in today's dollars would be, you know, tens of millions of dollars probably. The U.S., this is the USS Jeannette. It's a Navy expedition. It was run by Navy officers under naval rules. But the Navy of that time was quite weak, quite anemic, and it had to be this unique hybrid kind of thing, which would be now considered very unorthodox. The Navy would not go in with a newspaper publisher or, say, you know, Ted Turner, or who would be the equivalent today. But then there was really no other way to do this. And I think it said something about the kind of way we organize things in this country, that you could just some guy could come in with the money, the Navy provides the reinforcement for the ship and the expertise, and they head out from San Francisco toward the Bering Strait.
Well, and the captain is a man named George Washington DeLong, and he had made a name for himself actually trying to rescue a ship that had failed to do, I guess, the journey that he ends up taking. And so he was a pretty well-known captain at the time. And as you describe him, I mean, he seems like he was a good captain. I mean, a captain that, as he said, I command, they obey, talking about his crew, but nonetheless believed in that.
Yeah, he was very old school. He was very, very much of a disciplinarian. He was quite aware of the fact that all the Arctic explorations up to then had problems with mutiny and scurvy and sometimes cannibalism and all the classics. He was real clear on his leadership and how it had to be organized. What I love about him, many things actually,
yeah,
but he was a great writer. And when things really go bad, and they do go bad, and as bad as you can imagine, he still keeps writing in his journal, and he keeps saying, you know, these just great moments of understatement, and you know, like, we're in for a time today when they're, you know, dragging their boats across the ice or whatever. And he had this motto, nil desperandum, you know, never despair, never despair, never despair. And he held this group together over this ordeal.
Well, as you say, there were 32 members of the crew, a sort of a hodgepodge of people, including someone from who worked for the newspaper.
Yes.
Was there.
Yes, Bennett had to get his story out of this, so
well,
he had a
course.
Correspondent on board. Unfortunately, this correspondent had a terrible penchant for for puns. And after
2 years, which is a terrible thing, actually.
It started out fine, but after 2 years in the ice, it drove everyone else absolutely insane. This guy would not shut up with the puns and the limericks, but. There was a navigator who unfortunately went blind from syphilis. There were two Chinese guys who they got picked up in Chinatown in San Francisco. Two Inuit hunter dog drivers from Alaska, the new acquisition that we'd purchased from Russia. And very international cast of characters.
But you say an interesting thing that for some of them they were looking for adventure and perhaps glory, and that they had parents who fought in the Civil War, and they themselves wanted to be able to, I guess, be a man and go out and go to this sort of unknown part of the world.
Yeah, I mean, that was certainly part of the appeal. You might ask now, why would anyone want to go up there in a situation that was virtually guaranteed to produce death and hardship and starvation and so forth? But part of it was that this was the generation that had just missed the Civil War, and their uncles and fathers and grandfathers and brothers had fought in this great conflict, and they had missed it. And so there was an element of history had passed me by, let's do something equally big and ambitious. And that certainly was true for Captain DeLong. He had missed the Civil War by literally months, and there was almost like a chip on their shoulder, like, we got to do something even bigger. And Arctic exploration was one venue that was sort of accepted as a path to glory and a path to expanding national might and science as well, because it really was a genuine puzzle. People did not know what was up there, and it might be one of the great discoveries of all time. If perhaps there was a civilization, or actually was an open polar sea, this sort of thing.
And they left believing that there could be, or probably was, an open polar sea.
Yes, they did. I mean, I think here's the thing: they knew they would encounter ice because all the Arctic whalers had encountered ice, but the Arctic whalers had never intentionally rammed themselves in the ice, pointing north, hoping to get to this polar sea. They thought, the theory was that there was this girdle of ice. Sometimes it was called an annulus of ice, a ring of ice, that if you could just get through it, preferably finding a gateway where it was a little weak from one of these warm water currents like the Gulf Stream, you would finally break through and get to this sea. And that was the leading theory of the time.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation talking with Hampton Sides about his new book. It's called In the Kingdom of Ice, The Grand and Terrible Polar Voyage of the USS Jeannette. And again, the USS Jeannette left San Francisco in 1879. The idea was to go to the pole, at the North Pole, a place no one had ever been before. But tragedy ensued, adventures ensued as well. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. Any questions or comments, you can certainly join us. And again, that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can always send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
How should you react when a line of evergreens gets too big for its needles? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, we'll help a listener safely reduce the size of his bad view blocking hemlocks. Plus answers to all your growing questions. That's You Bet Your Garden, Saturday mornings at 7 a.m. and noon, right here on WHYY-FM.
Hi, I'm Stephen Quinn. What does brunch have to do with our understanding of class? Well, writer Sean McAuliffe makes his case for how the leisurely meal reflects our shifting attitudes towards status today. That's coming up on Cue the Summer from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. You may not know Gustavo Santaolalla, but you probably know his music. the case of Brokeback Mountain, for example, the whole score I did before one frame was shot. And obviously it was the genius of Ang Lee to say, I'm going to put this here, this here, this here.
That conversation next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen again talking with Hampton Sides about his new book, In the Kingdom of Ice. Now, the USS Jeannette is, what, about 28, 30 feet long, something like that. So not a huge ship.
Not a huge boat at all, no.
But what was interesting is that Edison helped to put lights in the ship. Alexander Graham Bell got involved as well. This was a pretty well-equipped ship.
Yeah, they wanted to have communications on the ship. They wanted to have lighting to light up the polar night. You know, it's dark for 6 months of the year. They wanted to have all the latest inventions. And this was a very well-equipped and well, you know, they also wanted to conduct a lot of scientific experiments while they were up there in terms of the quality of the ice and the depth of the water and salinity and barometric pressure. And, you know, so they had all the instruments that they needed to conduct essentially to create a weather station up there because they knew they would be in ice. They just thought it would be a few months. They didn't realize that it would be 2 years. And they were well-fed for the 2 years. They had plenty of food. They had entertainment. They had an organ on the ship. They had entertainments of all sorts and plays and musicals. They were kind of going slowly mad from boredom and inaction, but they were doing okay until the incredible pressure of the ice finally crushed the hull of the ship.
Yeah, which had been obviously reinforced. They had food for 3 years, and I'm trying to imagine in 1879, 1880, how do you – I mean, and I know that they also shot animals and things along the way, but nonetheless.
A lot of canned goods and a lot of pemmican, this really not terribly tasty stuff but fairly nutritious that can get you through the lean months. They also went out on the ice and hunted a lot of polar bear, and they were quite successful at it. So, you know, they weren't exactly suffering, although there were some hardships. There were some strange medical maladies. But for those 2 years, it was mostly just waiting for something to happen. They did discover three islands along the way that are now known as the DeLong Islands and are part of Russia, although there are groups here in the United States who think we need to seize them back because we did, in fact, raise a flag over them and claim them for the United States. They did a lot of things, including just taking daily and hourly measurements of everything up there on the way. But finally, the ship sank, and the story becomes a very different one.
Well, you include a meal that they had. This was for Christmas. Julienne soup for fish, spiced salmon for meats, Arctic turkey, I guess roast seal, cold ham, for vegetables, canned green peas, succotash macaroni with cheese and tomatoes, lots of desserts, including English canned plum pudding, and all sorts of nuts and raisins and walnuts, pale sherry for wines, a London stout for beer, French chocolate and coffee, hardtack and cigars.
Yeah, not so bad. Not so bad.
I mean, I realize that probably wasn't true every day.
No, but that was a special day. But, you know, DeLong understood that for morale purposes, you know, they had to celebrate every now and then and somehow break through the monotony of those 2 years.
And he seemed to understand that you had to keep a crew busy.
Right. Constantly busy, you know, constantly out on the ice, exercising, doing all sorts of tasks. And unfortunately, you know, Edison, we talked about Edison's lights. He was just perfecting it when we got them on the ship. And it was literally a couple of months later that he did perfect the lights. These lights unfortunately did not work. It was a real source of discouragement when they flipped the switch and they just fizzled. You know, nothing. And kind of a sign, kind of an augur augury of what was coming. You know,
well, Alexander Graham Bell put in telephones and telegraph. How did they do?
It didn't really work either. The wires got wet on the ice, and the signal fizzled after a while. So, you know, this was kind of a sign of what was coming. Everything was the technology was there, but it wasn't quite ready for prime time.
Well, you say an interesting thing, which is shortly after the Jeannette takes off, some scientists take a look at this open polar sea theory,
right,
and realize it's probably not true, but perhaps too late to tell the captain and the crew?
Yes. Literally, as the Jeannette is heading north, another ship from the Geodetic Survey is heading south and is going to get this information to Washington. It'll be digested, and they learn that there really isn't a warm water current sweeping up through the Bering Strait, softening the ice. And so yet another one of these sort of, just the timing was just off by a matter of months. This whole expedition was predicated on this theory that was false, and the information was just coming in that it was indeed false.
It's kind of amazing to imagine, you know, going out, first of all, not exactly knowing where you're going in today's, you know, GPS-centric
right.
world where we know exactly where we are all the time. But thinking as well that you'd be gone for, what, 2 or 3 years if you were going to take off on one of these voyages. Your book also includes some really touching letters that DeLong's wife writes, you know, hoping, I don't know if he ever got them.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't imagine.
She called them her letters to nowhere because she was sending them up to the Arctic via Arctic whaling vessels and other ships. And Emma DeLong, she becomes a major character in the book and was a great writer. Historians always wish for this sort of scenario to happen that happened to me. It's never happened before for me, but it's the phone call from a little old lady who basically says, I've got a trunk full of old letters.
How did she know you were doing this?
I actually called her looking for her late husband. I was calling everybody named DeLong in Connecticut because I'd heard that there were relatives there. And Catherine DeLong said, you know, that's so funny that you call because I've got this trunk full of letters and they are the personal papers of Emma DeLong, Commander DeLong's wife. And I really didn't know what to do with them. Would you like to come get them? On loan, of course. And I said, would I ever? I flew as quickly as I could to Connecticut. And these were her personal papers, including all of these letters that she wrote. She saved copies of all of these letters. And they're beautiful. And ultimately, as the story becomes more and more tragic, they're heart-wrenching letters. And she had sailed aboard the Jeannette around the Horn to San Francisco with her husband. She knew every inch of that vessel. She knew every detail about the expedition. So she wasn't just a romantic writer writing, in the abstract. She was writing about details of the expedition and the science that it was based on. And she becomes a major character in the book. It's really largely it's a love story between the two of them.
Well, at one point, even before they leave, he says to her, you know, you'll make a beautiful widow. I don't know if he was preparing her. But, I mean, these were dangerous trips.
Everyone knew that, there was a strong likelihood that you're going to die or suffer unimaginable horrors or starvation, scurvy, and whatever. So I don't think Emma had any doubts about how dangerous this was. She understood that. But nonetheless, his intention was to go to the North Pole and come out on the other side and make it home. And they had a child, Sylvie DeLong, and he certainly didn't have a death wish, and he wanted to get back.
He seemed to be just almost obsessed with the North Pole, the Arctic, with even ice itself.
Yeah. There's something that happens to people who go to the Arctic. Either you love it or you hate it. And he was one of the ones who absolutely fell in love with it when he went to Greenland several years before. The sounds, the atmospheric phenomena, what light does, obviously the northern lights, and then this terrific puzzle that we've been talking about that just pulls you in, and it's obsessive. So even though the food may be bad and the weather is horrible, and the conditions are very, very claustrophobic, and the snow and ice is monotonous, there's just something, just about everyone in that ship had been to the Arctic before, usually aboard whaling vessels, and they kept wanting to go back. They couldn't get enough of it.
And again, Hampton Sides, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. He has a new book. It's called In the Kingdom of Ice, and it's subtitled The Grand and Terrible Polar Voyage of the USS Jeannette. And again, the USS Jeannette set sail from San Francisco 1879 on an expedition to the North Pole. Within a few months, the ship was stuck in ice, and a couple of years later, it sank. And the book is in part about the preparation for this voyage and what happened to the captain and the crew and people in their lives as well. You can give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. And you can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. Any questions or comments, do give us a call or contact us. You describe, I guess, after, 2 years of being stuck in ice and really just floating, right? Mm-hmm. Floating in these ice flows?
Yeah, I mean, the ice is constantly moving, and if they're generally heading in the right direction, they're heading towards the North Pole, but it's a very circuitous route, and some days they're going backwards and sometimes they're going forward. Enormous pressures on the hull of the ship, but the ship had been massively reinforced and did quite well for most of that time, but finally the pressure became too great, and it made terrific noises and screeching sounds, and the pine tar was like coming out of the seams of the ship that was like being throttled to death, and finally it sank to the bottom of the Arctic Ocean. Wow. And these 33 men and their 40 dogs and three small open boats and some very bare supplies, they're out there 1,000 miles from the nearest landmass, which is the central coast of Siberia. And so they start dragging their stuff south. And it really becomes one of the great survival stories of all time. It's a Shackleton kind of story, 35 years before the Endurance, an American Shackleton. And that's in some ways where the story really begins.
Well, and I'm trying to imagine, again, trying to drag these boats across, I guess it's ice, but nonetheless, mm-hmm. just the what it would take, the kind of physical stamina you'd have to have to do something like that.
It's just so hard. And, everyone's in harness. They're essentially like mules, dragging this stuff. And, the ice pack is not like this nice, smooth surface that you can skate over or something like that. DeLong at one point says it's like trying to get across Manhattan by the rooftops, climbing over the rooftops and parapets of the city. It's just jagged and full of melt water and pools and puddles, and they keep falling in. Mm-hmm. And it's just unbelievably hard work. And they didn't have enough food, so they were constantly hunting as they went. They discover another island along the way, which is called Bennett Island, named after the publisher, James Gordon Bennett.
Oh.
and they that sort of saves them. They finally, have a place where they can have plenty to eat. They eat a lot of birds and other wildlife and kind of lick their wounds for a while and then keep heading on until they finally do reach open water set sail for the Siberian coast.
And we know all this because DeLong kept records.
Amazing records. I mean, the thing about him was, no matter how bad it was, at the end of the day, he's writing in his journal, and he's writing really quite beautiful passages. Everyone else who could write kept journals or log books. There's a lot of material. After they came home, there was a naval inquiry. There was a congressional inquiry. So there was a lot of testimony. And of course, Bennett wanted to get his scoop. So he sent reporters into Siberia and interviewed everyone who survived. So there's a lot of raw material to base this thing on.
You mentioned the fact that they had dogs, and I guess they picked up the dogs partially on the voyage north.
Yeah, they got them in Alaska, and the dogs were a big part of the story. Yeah. Everyone had their favorite dog. The dogs were, some of them went kind of mad and were pretty crazy, and others were beloved. And it's not the kind of story, however, unfortunately, like a lot of these Arctic stories that that the SPCA is going to like. They suffer and are consumed when things go really bad.
Well, in fact, DeLong, who had a dog that he seemed to really care for, realized at some point that we're just going to have to eat these dogs.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
hard to read that, I have to say, as a dog lover myself.
Yeah.
But under the circumstances.
There's Snoozer. There's one dog named Snoozer that was like the mascot. And, I'm not even going to say. It's sad, though.
It is sad. It is
You can
sad.
Imagine.
So did they know when their boat sank and they're heading off, did they know where they were going?
Well, they knew basically where they were going. I mean, they were heading for this place called the Lena Delta, which is the delta of a very large river system. The Lena River is the eighth largest river in the world. And they figured there would be natives there who are hunters and trappers who would rescue them. That's where they set out for. The problem was, much of the time, they would be going south, struggling over the ice. They would take a positional reading only to find out that the ice over which they had been heading was actually drifting north faster than they had been going south. So they had actually retrogressed. And nothing more demoralizing than that, kind of this Sisyphean idea of just like the more I work, the farther I am away from my goal. And this was really tough for DeLong. This was his lowest moment.
Well, and one can only imagine just how cold it was. You talk, mm-hmm. you know, you write about these blinding snowstorms, there are pictures of obviously them with their coats and all, but nonetheless, you know, how do you stay warm under those circumstances? Yeah. Perhaps you can't.
Yeah. Well, luckily, the ship sank in June, and this was summertime, so there was endless amount of sunlight, and it was surprisingly warm during the middle of the day for much of this. But that brings its own problems because there's meltwater everywhere. They're constantly wet. They're constantly falling in. You know, you're never really sure what time of year is the best time of year because they could actually move faster when it's really cold and hard out there. So, but they do reach open water and they set sail in these three boats. And these three boats have three very different fates.
One also has to think about the kind of psychological stamina. I mean, obviously, mm-hmm. these were people used to hardship and used to perhaps dangerous situations and perhaps even wanting it.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, to be...
God, they were so tough. And whenever I'm having a bad day, you know, I just kind of
go... You think about these men?
It's like, come on, buck up, dude. You know, it's really not that bad because what they were going through and going through really without complaining, summoning up all these reserves of physical stamina, psychological strength, sometimes spiritual strength, sometimes just purely a sense of humor is what seems to have gotten them through this. You realize that we're a lot softer generation than they were. That's for sure. And, you know, a lot of this also becomes a story of leadership, of how were they organized.
DeLong, right.
DeLong organized this retreat, and this retreat is like, I mean, this is a huge expanse of ice to try to get across, and it's really one of the more difficult, you know, stories of endurance that you can ever imagine. So he organized it into these three groups and kind of had the three groups compete against each other so that there was a group rivalry almost and a friendly rivalry. And that seemed to work. Each ship had a motto. I mean, each group had its own motto. It had its own tents. It had its own little camp. And this was a really brilliant idea, I think. He also organized it so they would march during the nighttime. There is no actual night because the sun is 24/7, but right. It was cooler at night, and they would sleep during the day, and thus be a little less likely to get snow blindness. And, you know, there was a lot of thought that went into how to organize and prosecute this march across the ice.
Well, again, our guest is Hampton Sides. The book is In the Kingdom of Ice, and it's In the Kingdom of Ice. Yes, I got that right. The Grand and Terrible Polar Voyage of the USS Jeannette. Hampton Sides is an editor at Outside Magazine, also a contributor to National Geographic. He's also the author of a number of other books as well. We're going to take a very short break. And again, talking about this adventure, any questions, 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Next time on The Pulse.
Are you having any problems?
I haven't been really sleeping that well lately.
Yeah.
Just not feeling like myself.
Diagnosis, menopause. Mood swings, hot flashes, memory problems.
Do you remember that movie where that woman who's
married to that guy, you know, and there'll be a domino of forgetting.
But what to do about it?
My doctor will not prescribe hormone therapy.
The Pulse, tomorrow morning at 9 on WHYY.
On the next Fresh Air, ancient Sufi and Christian chants. We talk with Jason Hamaker about recording this sacred music in Syria before the Civil War. And jazz trumpeter Dave Douglas and pianist Ori Kane tell us about their new duet album that includes hymns from the Sacred Harp Songbook. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Giving Africa the business. Someone wants a give back.
I don't know a single African that does not want business or investment in Africa. However, sustainable development in Africa depends on having responsible business.
A conversation about the right way to do business development in Africa next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Just to recap, back in the late 19th century, Americans were gripped with something called Arctic fever. So in 1879, the USS Jeannette sailed out of San Francisco, hoping to be the first to go to the North Pole. But sadly, within a few months, the ship became locked in ice. It eventually sank. It stranded its captain and crew. They headed off across the icy and inhospitable terrain to Siberia. They battled starvation, frostbite, blinding storms, and polar bears, which they also ate. And again, our guest, Hampton Sides, tells this harrowing but exhilarating, exciting story in his new book called In the Kingdom of Ice. 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. I'd love to have you read another section from the book.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, when they make landfall, DeLong and his men start to really suffer. In some ways, their travails just get worse and worse once they hit land where they thought they'd be saved. So eventually, he decides to send ahead the two sort of strongest, youngest, toughest guys to try to find civilization, to try to find some settlement. And these men were Nendemen and Noros. And so where I read here just picks up where they kind of take off on their own. As Nendemen and Noros marched over the Lena wastelands, the Siberian winter fell upon them like an untethered weight. Each night grew colder than the last, with temperatures reaching well below zero. It seemed at times that only their constant movement kept them from freezing to death. Sounds became brittle. The fluids in their faces hardened. The snow squeaked underfoot. The cold had become a physical presence, silently snatching the life from the delta in the way that a fire consumes the oxygen in a room. In the coldest hours of the night, their breaths froze in the air and drifted to the ground in glittery clouds, which, according to local tribesmen, made a faint tinkling melody called the Whisper of the Stars. The coldest temperature ever recorded in the Northern Hemisphere, 90 degrees below zero Fahrenheit, would later be captured at a Soviet weather station to the east of the Lena River. Nendemen and Noros moved steadily and determinedly, but they were too weak to move swiftly. They averaged about 13 miles a day. Noros spat up blood and began to entertain ideas of shooting himself. In his lowest moments, only thoughts of his family back in Fall River, Massachusetts, kept him from taking his life. Much of their journey seemed like a dream, a long whiteout of undifferentiated days punctuated by a few moments of haunting clarity, a snowy owl staring at them, a pile of decrepit sleds they smashed up for firewood, the corpse of a native buried in a box on a hill, a crow circling and circling and circling.
I mean, it's a beautiful passage and also absolutely terrifying to imagine being one of those two guys as they take off, hoping to rescue themselves and the rest of the crew.
Yeah, I went to the Lena Delta on a trip and to see this landscape. I really wanted to see it and understand it as best I could. There are really only two seasons in that part of the world. There's winter and then there's mosquito. I went during
which would be summer, right?
I went during August and I went in full mosquito and you know, you're splashing through just these endless, you know, river channels and back channels and islands, and it's a labyrinth, and it's constantly changing. Every year it looks a little different. It's just a huge wasteland and very desolate. It's kind of, I would say it's beautiful, but it's, you know, it's well above the tree line. It's tundra, it's permafrost, and unfortunately, it's also only seasonally inhabited. And by the time that Nindemann and Norris reached this land, they had all pulled back from the delta to go back to their villages way, way to the south. And so they, again, as so many times during this expedition, their timing was off by just a few weeks or a few days. And they marched and marched and marched for hundreds of miles until they finally did. I'm not going to say exactly what happens, but it takes a long time before they encounter another soul.
This must have been, though, big news at the time. I mean, the fact that this USS Jeannette took off and it was funded by this eccentric but obviously very wealthy person who wanted, or this man who obviously wanted to make some news for himself
well.
So.
And so he funds, Bennett funds, a number of other vessels to go north to find out what happened to the Jeannette. And, of course, these vessels, in turn, run into all kinds of troubles. One of the vessels that is better known was a ship called the Corwin, which was sent up to the Bering Strait to Wrangel Island off the coast of Siberia to look for Jeannette, And on that ship was John Muir, the conservationist, who at that time was a newspaper reporter in San Francisco, and he wrote this amazing account of looking for the Jeannette. They were the first folks to make landfall on Wrangel Island and claimed it for the United States. They never did find any evidence of the Jeannette, but they had amazing adventures of their own, and Muir wrote about it beautifully.
There was someone on board the ship who has some connections here to Philadelphia, a guy named George Melville,
yes.
Who grew up in Sharon Hill.
Yes. Melville was becomes one of the great heroes of the story. He was the engineer, and he ultimately, after the Jeannette expedition, became the chief engineer of the U.S. Navy. And there's a beautiful portrait of him here in the art gallery here in Philadelphia. And just a great character, distantly related to Herman Melville, and certainly one of the local connections to the story.
You know, I have to say, having read the book, how could this story have been forgotten, which mm-hmm. it largely has been?
Yeah. Well, I think one of the reasons for that, because I wondered about it, you know, this was best-selling books. Everybody knew these folks' names. They were sort of like astronauts of their day. There were 15 to 20,000 people gathered at San Francisco when they launched. How could this thing have been forgotten? And I think one of the things that happened was all the expedition photographs that had been taken went down with the ship. And there were, even if they hadn't gone down with the ship, we probably wouldn't have gotten them because they're so heavy to lug across the ice. Would have been nearly impossible. We're such a visual culture, I think, that, you know, without having those images, it's it's something that, like, for example, the Shackleton expedition had these amazing photographs that allowed people to really understand it. I think that's part of it. I think also success is a big thing we like to celebrate in this country, and we like to succeed, you know. And if you're not first, you're last. And the Brits don't seem to have that problem. Whether they succeed or don't with their Arctic expeditions, they mythologize them, like Franklin, for example, or Scott. Although they reached the South Pole, they all died. Shackleton, in fact, was a failure, except that they did make it home. So I think success element of it was part of it. And it was superseded by other expeditions, including Parry, who did reach the North Pole or thereabouts. So I think that's part of it as well.
What's interesting, though, is that DeLong, the captain, through all of these travails, he keeps his diaries or his journals. He mm-hmm. does not toss them. I mean, he must have had some thought of certainly survival, but also that what they were doing was important.
Yes.
Was going to be important.
Yes. Well, he dragged these diaries and also logbooks all across the ice. And many times he was asking, God, these things are heavy. Why am I doing this? But he viewed them almost as relics. If they went so... The all record of the expedition might go down, and then it would be it would be lost to obscurity. So he did drag these books. They eventually made it home and became best-selling books. And it's a really interesting read. He was just quite an adventurer. And no matter how bad things were going, he was very disciplined about writing every day what was happening.
And how did you get interested in the story? And there, some of the other books that you've written are also about hardship.
Yeah. Well, I had written a book about the Bataan Death March in World War II, Ghost Soldiers. I wrote a book about the life and times of Kit Carson and his role in the conquest of the American West. That's a book called Blood and Thunder. You know, how this book fits in, I don't know exactly. I'm interested in stories about sort of like these ragtag bands of men and how they survive and how they get through these unbelievable hardships. And when I first heard about this story was actually when I was doing a story for National Geographic in Oslo, Norway, about a Norwegian explorer named Fridtjof Nansen, who was obsessed with the Jeannette expedition. He kept referencing it, Jeannette, 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 and here I am, an American. I've never heard of this voyage. I never heard of DeLong. And I just filed that away and became, you know, decided to find, like, what were there any primary materials? Yes, mm-hmm. there were. There were great diaries, journals, and so forth. So bit by bit, I became, I guess you could say, obsessed with it myself. And this book took me about 4 years to do. And I thought that because of our now, you know, renewed interest in the Arctic because of climate change, and also because of our complicated relationship with Russia, that this was an interesting and a fortuitous time to revisit this story and try to resurrect it. I mean, the ultimate irony to all this is that DeLong set off in search of an open polar sea. And it didn't exist. But the climate experts are now telling us that in a few short years, at least during summertime, there will be an open polar sea. So maybe he wasn't so quixotic or crazy. He was just off by 140 years.
But we're talking about by 2050, I think you write in the book, scientists are saying that there probably, I guess in summertime, will be an open polar sea.
Yes.
Which is pretty frightening to think about.
And, I mean, every summer is different. The ice is constantly changing, but that's the trend. And it's one of the things that they're using to sort of study how the ice has changed so much is those logbooks that the Jeannette lugged across the ice. They ended up in the National Archives. NOAA has been studying and digitizing all this information, and it's showing that the ice has deteriorated even faster than we thought.
Because he was taking measurements, I guess, as
every day.
Every day as they were going along.
Ice thickness, salinity, the drift direction, temperature. And so all of this science that they were doing over 2 years has actually proved to be surprisingly useful.
Do you think, I mean, it's interesting that you've written three books sort of about hardship and, you know, men travailing over over some kind of hardship. Do you think it's that you've learned something about yourself doing writing these books?
Well, I always, you know, when I'm writing these passages, I'm always wondering how I would have gotten through this, and how would I have survived? And when I went to the Arctic myself, and we got stuck in the ice one time, we were in a Russian icebreaker, and we actually were brought to a standstill two or three times by the ice pack, and I just I looked out over that ice, and I just thought, I tried to imagine what DeLong was thinking, you know, and you know, all I can say is these guys were a hell of a lot tougher than we are and than I am, certainly. The impulse to explore, the impulse to endure and to get through these situations is universal, and I think we still have it, absolutely. But I think the real difference is just, you know, there were thousands and thousands of people who applied for this expedition. People were lining up in droves to get on this vessel and ram themselves into the ice for the privilege of possibly reaching the North Pole first. And that's where we've changed. And that's something that, you know, now that we know that there's really nothing up there, it's just a shifting, you know, carapace of ice. It seems kind of silly and ludicrous. And we have to kind of remember how little was known and how epic this adventure seemed to young men of that time.
And what's it like on a Russian icebreaker? I'm just trying to imagine.
Well, it's really a formidable vessel, but when it starts to shake and shudder and then is actually brought to a standstill, it's actually fairly terrifying. And but you know, we rammed our way through it, and we got to Wrangel Island, which is a fascinating place. It's got the large, it's the largest denning ground for polar bear, and we saw a lot of walrus, and we saw you know, walked all over the place where Muir and his group of rescuers went, and it was fascinating, really. Yeah. That was the best, one of the best parts of the research.
I was just going to ask you, was that the best part of the research? I mean, just to be able to go there.
Yeah. I love, you know, with all these books, I feel like it's, if you can go there, you've got to go there. It's that's the fun part, but it enables you to talk about the weather and the landscape and the architecture or the, you know, the just the lay of the land. It's important when I'm writing those passages to feel like I physically touched it. And, you know, it's much better than sitting in the archives. That's the next phase, and I do that too. But it's more rewarding to physically go to these landscapes.
There's so many people that were obviously part of this great adventure. So whatever happens to James Gordon Bennett, he's the owner of the New York Herald, as you say, a very eccentric person with a lot of money.
Yeah, yeah. Well, he was really into sports and adventure, and he brought polo to the United States. He brought competitive tennis to the United States at a place called the Newport Casino, which is now the Tennis Hall of Fame. When automobiles became a thing, he created an auto race, the Gordon Bennett Cup.
And he liked to race.
And he loved
right?
to race. And he himself raced a lot. He was he won the first transatlantic yacht race. And he also used to race around Manhattan nude on a coach pulled by, you know, a team of horses in this form of racing that was a big thing then. He was outrageous, outlandish character. He urinated in a grand piano at a party and got himself ostracized, and he was flogged in the streets, and then he was in a duel, and then he ended up in Paris, where he started the Paris Herald, which ultimately became the International Herald Tribune. He's buried in Paris. He had unbelievable yachts, women galore. He also created a balloon race, which still exists to this day, the Gordon Bennett Cup balloon, international balloon race. So, you know, just a great Gilded Age character, and the you know, the person who really bankrolled this entire expedition.
Well, on that note, Hampton Sides, thanks for joining us today on Radio Times.
Great being here.
Nice to have you here. And the book is In the Kingdom of Ice, The Grand and Terrible Polar Voyage of the USS Jeannette. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out much more about this program, including Facebook and Twitter, email archives, podcasts. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us. You can catch